Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast on the Times. I'm Matt Chorley at a special live podcast recorded in Liverpool. In this special episode, recorded while the Labour Party conference is going on in Liverpool, we're asking the question, have we reached peak Corbyn? Can Jeremy Corbyn build on the unexpected success at the general election last year to go on to become Prime Minister, or is it all downhill from here? Joining me on the panel, we've got Matt Zarb-Cousin, former spokesman for Jeremy Corbyn, Rachel Sylvester, Times columnist, and Jenny Russell, Times columnist, and Rosa Prince, biographer of both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, who can maybe compare the two leaders, the potential of both of them to basically muck it up over the next couple of years. Welcome to you all. Let's start with you, Matt. You worked for Jeremy Corbyn for some time in the before the 2017 election. Explain a bit about what you expected to happen in the election, what then did happen, and how you think he might be able to build on that.
Well, I think I actually expected The polls would swing a lot to Labour in the course of the campaign, and towards the end, I think a couple of weeks before the election, I did think that it would be a hung parliament. I think I said it on your podcast at the time, because I think, especially since 2008, I think people have seen their material circumstances decline quite significantly, and Brexit was a symptom of that in the sense that I just think that Leave picked up a lot of votes because they were making a kind of anti-austerity argument about NHS funding and about, you know, people felt a loss of control. They felt their communities weren't being invested in. And I just thought if we can put together a program, policy program, that demonstrates quite explicitly how we're going to improve the material circumstances of most people, we're going to take this money and we tax these people that have actually done quite well in the last 8 years, you know, even though you haven't, and we're going to transfer that wealth to people, we're going to reinvest in public services. And if that message can cut through to people, because it did in a general election campaign, because the broadcast election rules kick in, and then obviously you had a Conservative Party not really saying much, which helped, but Labour able to announce policies every day and people actually engaged in politics, I thought that was going to be work very much in their favour. And actually, Corbyn is a necessary component of that kind of politics, which creates an antagonism, because usually what politicians say and do in general election campaigns is they make politician statements which people don't, you know, which people can't possibly disagree with. So they say things like, "I want everyone to fulfil their potential," or they'll say, I want the economy to grow, right? And no one can disagree with these statements. But what Corbyn did in the election was he said things that people could, in theory, disagree with. He said, "I'm going to tax corporations more, and I'm going to use that money to fund public services." Now, you can actually say, "I don't think we should tax these people more, because I don't think we should fund in public services." And Corbyn is the first Labour politician in a long time to approach politics in that way. He creates an antagonism, and he's not afraid to try to win the argument from his perspective.
Do you think he can do that again? The question: have we, was that a peak last year, or can he sort of recreate that and build on that again?
Well, everyone's material circumstances are getting worse. The economy is getting worse. The context is perfect for those sorts of that sort of politics to work again. If anything, it will be better next time around. So
let's bring you, Rachel, in. What do you make of it? Have we reached Pete Corbyn?
I think Pete Corbyn was probably the Glastonbury crowd when he was chanted his name by an adoring crowd of young and enthusiastic fans. And there was, I think Matt's right, that he tapped into a real desire for change. And there was an optimism to his message and a radicalism that appealed especially to young people. And that was sort of epitomised by that moment, really. But there was always, I think, and is, a darker side to the hard left that we've also seen coming out more recently in things like the anti-Semitism and these calls for mandatory reselections and some of the really nasty abuse on Twitter. And obviously that's not exclusively on the hard left, but it has been coming out. So I think, and then also there's been the sort of Corbyn himself has fallen out with those young idealistic supporters potentially, or there's a clash between them over Brexit and Europe. So if you like the sort of happy, optimistic side of Corbyn and the darker side are becoming a clash. And the happy side is what created Pete Corbyn. And the darker side is kind of, I think, is the greatest threat to him and his success. But that doesn't mean necessarily that he's finished, because I think the problem is Theresa May and the Tories are making such an absolutely massive hash of the EU negotiations. You could still end up with Jeremy Corbyn in number 10, but it's not so much Pete Corbyn as sort of Dick Theresa or Sean Theresa.
Rosa, part of the problem for all politicians is that the longer they are, particularly a party leader, they just pick up baggage. They just collect bad news and misjudgments and upset people, and it's difficult to sustain the idea of the new, fresh guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the 2017 election saw a particular set of circumstances because you had a very hubristic prime minister who went to the country and asked for a certain thing, and the public said, you know what, we don't want you, we want to give the establishment a kicking. And it was almost a kind of boat-faced election, wasn't it? It was all very fun and very jolly, and lots of young people and older people got behind Jeremy Corbyn in those weeks and had a great time. I don't see those circumstances being repeated again. I think you're right. I think you'd get a kind of fatigue with a leader, and that excitement won't exist, and Glastonbury won't see old Jeremy Corbyn again. But I also think that Matt's right, that there is an appetite out there for more left-wing politics than had been assumed in the past that the public would accept. And I think Rachel's right to say that we shouldn't underestimate how badly the government and Theresa May are doing. And although a couple of years ago when I first wrote the book about Jeremy Corbyn, I didn't think for a moment he would one day become Prime Minister. I no longer feel that way. I think it's, you know, perhaps 50-50, perhaps even tipping towards the 60-40 that he can do it. So although I think we have reached peak Corbyn in terms of the personality cult, I certainly don't think we've reached the peak of what he could achieve. Now, does he do the things that he needs to do to help him on the way? No, he doesn't seem to be willing to do that, but the way politics is going, perhaps he doesn't need to.
Jenny, what do you make of the trying to, it's very difficult to keep up the sustained campaign. Jeremy Corbyn has talked about doing it. He tried to, every summer he seems to want to go on tours, sort of keep up momentum with a small M. That's difficult, isn't it? People want to switch off between elections. They don't want to constantly be on a sort of campaign footing.
Oh, I don't know. I think people love having, you know, communal events. That's why they go to football matches every week. And I think the kind of people that go to Corbyn rallies probably think, just as people in America want to go to Trump rallies, they're enjoying participating in something where you can think, I'm on the side of right, and here's a good person who's offering me the way forward. I very much doubt that it's the rallies that are going to stop happening. I just think Corbyn is in an astonishing position, because you look at the political landscape and you think, well, the Tories are doing appallingly, and there's no alternative leader in sight. So then you sort of and think, oh my God, but Labour's doing so badly as well and not answering the main question of the day on Brexit. And then you look at the Lib Dems and
do you?
Vanished, so
you does anybody do that?
So you keep searching round and round, and you think, my God, they're all terrible. So who knows which one is going to look strongest over the next 6 months or a year? And I think anyone who thought that they could make any kind of prediction about who was going to come out well in this political landscape next week, let alone next month or in March, would be an absolute fool. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to some senior journalists there about what was happening with Trump, and I said to a columnist there, what is going to happen next? And he said, my crystal ball is broken. He said, what's going to happen in the UK? I said, my crystal ball is also broken. What's so fascinating about Corbyn now is that clearly his party, in terms of Brexit, is wanting to go in a place that he doesn't want to go. He could obviously pick up a tide if he decided to move, but it would go against all his instincts, and we know how obstinate he is, and we'll know within 24 hours whether he's managed to do a fudge so that the party never gets to vote on whether there should be a second referendum. So he could soar in the polls, so he would not have reached Pete Corbyn, or he could absolutely flail.
Do you think it's definitely... Obviously, the big debate that's happening in the Labour conference is whether or not they should back a second referendum. And do you think they would soar in the polls if they did that? Because actually, wouldn't he upset half of the coalition that he's managed to hold together of Labour leavers and Labour remainers up until now?
Well, I'd have thought that until the recent polling. Now, of course, we all know that polling is not that reliable, as we've all discovered to our cost in referendums and elections recently. But the YouGov poll 10 days or so ago showed that Labour would end up with a net gain of 1.5 million votes countrywide, which would be just about enough to give it a majority. They'd win 66 seats on that basis. And then, of course, there's just been the poll over the past couple of days showing that 86% of Labour voters would support a second referendum. So both within the party and within the country, it looks as if that would be a hugely popular thing to do. I might just get to know the sort of equal balance that you've got with May in the polls at the moment.
As you've brought up polls, let's take a look at some of the polling. From when Jeremy Corbyn became Labour leader, he was right that less than 20% of people thought that he would make the best Prime Minister. What we saw during the general election campaign was he went up almost exactly at the same speed as Theresa May went down. The more of a hash she made of her Nothing Has Changed campaign, the better Jeremy Corbyn did. But what's interesting is that since then, he has gradually, there is a clear trajectory coming down. There's only now 23% of people in the most recent YouGov poll said that Jeremy Corbyn would make the best Prime Minister. 36% said Theresa May, and the overwhelming leader for some time has been don't know on 39%.
39%. Don't know it's going up. Don't know it's going up.
Don't know it's doing very well. Whoever changes their name to don't know will be laughing. Interestingly, there is a similar trajectory on the party voting, which is not as pronounced. And arguably, if you looked at the crisscrossing of the Tory party and the Labour party, it's essentially a dead heat. It could easily change one way or the other during the course of a general election campaign. But this was interesting. This was a breakdown of Labour voters, so people who voted Labour in 2017, asked who do you think would make the best PM. 86% of those people said Jeremy Corbyn in June last year, just after the general election. That's gone down to 51%. Wow. So the idea that he needs to build on what he secured last year is based on the premise that he's already got those people in the bag, and that's not the case. I mean, admittedly, almost all of that has gone to you don't know, rather than Theresa May. Matt?
But don't know isn't neither. That's the thing. It's people saying, I'm not engaged with politics at the moment. I just voted in an election last year. I don't know. Yep. I don't know who'll be the best Prime Minister of the two. And when I have to make my mind up, and I'll engage with politics and I will come to a decision. It's not neither, you know.
But I do think also there was a slightly false thing in the election last year where quite a lot of people were voting against the other parties. So I think quite a lot of the people who voted Labour were voting against Theresa May and her hard Brexit.
And the idea for a lot of it that she was going to get a massive majority.
And then also I think some of the people who were voting for Labour, the other way around, were voting against Jeremy Corbyn because they were frightened of potential government heat leaks, and I think.
And we also know from the testimony of many Labour MPs who didn't support Corbyn that they were actually going up on the doorsteps and saying to people, it's fine, you can vote for Labour and vote for me because it's okay, we won't win. So you're not actually voting for Jeremy Corbyn. So that also inflated his support in some way.
And that's just not, Rosa, a plausible tactic the next time round, is it?
Well, I think he will come under greater scrutiny. I mean, I think he and his team would argue that he gets a hard time from the media. I mean, I think that personally, as a journalist, I would say this, but I think that's sort of part of the
you want to be prime minister,
yeah, that you should be scrutinised. And the Tories ran a terrible campaign, and they didn't really examine him as they could have done, as we have seen through all the stuff that's come out subsequently. And I wonder if, knowing some of the things that we've seen that have been pretty unsavoury, whether the public will think of again, and whether he will seem like this sort of genial grandfather figure, this wise old man. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be... I have found it very disturbing and unsettling, the anti-Semitism row. It'll be interesting to see whether the British public is upset about that, if that's one of the factors that motivates them, or whether they do pay more attention to their own circumstances, their own financial circumstances, and as Matt says, that austerity is enough and they want a Labour Party again. Because
Ginny makes a really interesting point, though, I think, too, that the idea that if next time Labour MPs, what are they going to do, these Labour MPs? Can they credibly go out and say, privately, they'll say quite often that they think Jeremy Corbyn would be a threat to national security as Prime Minister, that they fear what he'd do, they genuinely don't want him to be in number 10. What are they going to do between now and the next election? Are they going to stand on the Labour ticket? Are they going to break away? If they do stand on the Labour ticket, what will they say about Jeremy Corbyn? And that could have a big impact on his reputation and also on Labour's poll ratings. Because if there was a breakaway, that could also divide the sort of centre-left vote. So I think it's much more unpredictable for him than it might look.
Matt, what do you make of the idea of a group of Labour MPs breaking away? Do you think that's a realistic possibility?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, in a two-party system, which is what we have with First Past the Post, division is inevitable. You're never going to have two parties that represent the entire spectrum of political opinion. So you are going to get broad churches in both parties. Now, I think that there is a section of the Parliamentary Labour Party, people like, for example, Chris Leslie and Chukwu Mona, who could never reconcile themselves ideologically with Corbyn being Prime Minister. Therefore, it wouldn't surprise me if they did break away. It would be better for Corbyn and better for the Labour Party if they broke away before a general election, because then they would just lose their seats and that would be the end of it, rather than after, where they could hold a Corbyn government to ransom, effectively, if they needed those votes and those seats to have a majority.
But then who's representing that sort of strain of political opinion? If Labour's supposed to be a broad church...
Well, they don't have to leave.
But they're facing all these mandatory re-selection threats.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's difficult to keep your constituents on side. You see your constituency Labour Party members on side. I think that there are, for example, Kate Hoey would be the subject of a re-selection contest if that rule change passes, because of her opinions on Brexit. Now, I think that you have to have some degree of democratic accountability to your CLP, but I don't think that necessarily precludes certain opinions.
Matt, there seems to be a deep contradiction there. You say the parties are broad churches, and then you say that people who feel as Chris Leslie and Chukwu Mona do, be better if they just left.
I said if they're going to leave, it's better if they leave now.
And you'd rather they stayed in and kept on arguing their case for their kind of politics?
Well, they can if they like. They're free to do what they like. But
would you rather?
Oh, would I rather? Mm. I mean, it's entirely up to them. I don't mind if they want to do that. But I just don't think that they can...
Do you think parties ought to be broad churches?
Well, I think, it's inevitable with a two-party system and First Past the Post.
You're going to have broad churches. The moderate wing of the party are feeling increasingly unwelcome within the party, and they're facing enormous pressure not to express their views, and they're feeling extremely unpopular within it because of a small group who are acting against them.
I disagree. I think they're perfectly entitled to express their views. I just think the manner...
You don't think that's happening to them?
They are not being criticised for expressing their views. Everyone's allowed to express their views. They're being criticised because they're trying to actively undermine the Labour Party and therefore prevent a Labour government. That's why they're being criticised by the membership. The membership want a Labour government.
When Jeremy Corbyn was a backbench MP during the New Labour years, there weren't moves by Tony Blair to deselect him and replace him with somebody who was fully paid up to the New Labour way of thinking. That's the whole point of a broad church.
Well, actually,
it can't be a broad church as long as you agree with the vicar.
Well, actually... No, that's not what I was saying. I mean, MPs, Labour MPs, have to reconcile themselves in some way to the constituency Labour Party. there was actually an attempt to deselect Corbyn from within his constituency. They didn't meet the threshold because his constituency, Labour Party, supports him. And that's the way I think it should be. These are the activists that go out on the doorstep. They take the message to the public. You know, there has to be some kind of accountability to members as well.
But we also know that one of your key problems is that being accountable to members is not the same thing as being popular with voters. And if you expect to win power, then you can't afford just to be accountable to a small section of the electorate. We're seeing that's exactly what's happening with the Tory party at the moment. They're in hock to their Eurosceptic right wing, which is why the country is in such an almighty mess. And I think it's very dangerous if you and the Labour Party are making exactly the same mistake. It's why almost everybody that I know, whether they once voted Tory or whether they once voted Labour, is now feeling politically homeless, which doesn't mean they want to join a new centrist party. I don't think that's going to run. But they would like to get their broad churches back again so that they feel that the sensible moderates have also got a voice and they're not being excluded.
I think your argument there about the membership being out of step with public opinion might have been more convincing before the last election. But I actually think that the policies...
You didn't win.
I know, but the policies that were put forward in that election individually polled overwhelmingly well.
But that's not the point. Policies also polled overwhelmingly well before the election individually. And then the public looked at the whole thing together and thought, actually, we can't all have Christmas cake with cherries every day. You know, it doesn't add up.
But also
the context has changed.
In the end, wasn't Jeremy Corbyn a better politician than Ed Miliband in terms of going out and selling it and creating
a movement? Sure, but they still can win against a completely divided Tory party with the Prime Minister whose ratings were falling every single day during that campaign, and they still couldn't get over the line. So I think it's delusory to certain think that Pete Corbyn has necessarily yet to come.
But what I don't understand, and I've never really understood from day one of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership is, I mean, I understand on one level because he, as you say, is an obstinate man, but it would be so much easier and surely better for the Labour Party for that broad church to be embraced, for the moderates to be embraced, for Labour to be coming here to Liverpool and talk about the next Labour government and not talking about reselection or anti-Semitism. I mean, how can that be a positive thing for the party? How can that be a winning strategy? Well, quite. I mean, these are surely no one in the top of Team Corbyn can think that this is the way to achieve power and the way to offer a positive message to the public.
Actually, I think debate and discussion and difference of opinion at conferences should be what conferences are for, and it should be where debates and disputes are resolved through democratic means. But the power of conference has been so undermined over the last two decades that actually it does become a load of fringe events and people briefing the press. I actually think that you've seen in the debate over mandatory reselection, actually, I mean, I know it's an example that you prefer not to see, but there is division in the left among Unite and Momentum, and over Brexit as well. And that debate is being had in a comradely way, And it will be resolved at conference.
So that's what's really fascinating about this Brexit second referendum thing, because what's going to happen is there's a sort of meetings tonight, I think, to work out what exactly the motion is that the conference will get to vote on. And, you know, I think it's something like 130 local constituency parties have put in requests to the leadership to say, please, we really want another referendum on Brexit. And the suspicion, probably by the time the podcast comes out, we'll know the result. But there's a possibility that what comes back as the actual motion they get to vote on is something very wishy-washy and fudgy. And I don't think that really then is democracy in action and sort of power to the members. And I think there's a real conflict there, because when it's inconvenient for Jeremy Corbyn and the leadership, they actually don't want power to the members.
Well,
this is actually a perfect example of where, the you know, he's saying on the Andrew Marr programme this morning, Tom Watson's saying, yes, if the members vote for a second referendum, we'll back it. But what if they don't really get the chance to vote for it?
But also, there is an irony that Jeremy Corbyn has spent years saying that party should be more democratic, it should be opened up to the members, and then when the members come forward with something which is a bit uncomfortable for him and causes him a problem, you speak to some of the people in the sort of Corbyn camp now, and that's really annoying that suddenly we can't make conference do what we wanted them to do.
Maybe it will be genuinely democratic, and that would be fantastic. We'll see.
But it's high risk, isn't it, Jenny, that if the party does back a second referendum, it plunges the Labour Party back into a conversation. It basically reignites a conversation from 2 years ago, where it becomes very backward-looking rather than forward-looking. We don't even know what a question would be, Len McCluskey talking about not even having Remain on a ballot paper in a second referendum, which I don't think is what the people who want a second referendum, I don't think they're campaigning for a vote where staying in isn't an option.
Well, I think there are two things here. The first is that this Brexit decision, what may or may not happen to us by March, is going to be the most possibly destructive political decision of our lifetimes. The economy will take 4 decades to recover if we leave under a hard Brexit. We know that from all the people who've been talking about it at the top of the economy, from the governor of the Bank of England down. And so I think Labour has a deep, deep responsibility to think about something other than its own navel and its own narrow political interest at this point. And I thought it was utterly shameful last week that Chequers falls apart in Brussels, the Labour Party does not appear on any of the main political programmes, will not put spokesman up on Today or Channel 4 News or anything else to say what its view is about where we go forward. It's a total dereliction of the duty of the opposition. And secondly, I think that if they now adopted this policy of going for a second referendum, the point is that we would no longer be discussing cakes, cherries and unicorns. We would not be discussing the fact that we would have to be discussing the fact that last time around, during the Brexit campaign, the Brexiteers were able to promise with gay abandon anything they pleased, because they all thought, from Boris Johnson and Michael Gove downwards, they were absolutely convinced that they could not and would not win. So they were able to promise anything they pleased because they knew they weren't going to have to deliver it. That is why they looked like a bunch of shot rabbits on the morning of the referendum. And that's why they, all of them, went to ground and had nothing to say. If you remember, the only adult who appeared in charge of that situation the following day was the governor of the Bank of England. So now we would be faced not with this idea that, oh, you can leave the European Union and get rid of all the bits you don't like and keep all the bits that are splendid and there will be no cost to be paid. We now know that that is rubbish. So if we had a referendum, I think we would need a two-stage referendum in which in the first week, just like the French presidential election, you present the electorate with 3 choices. You'd say, do you want whatever deal the government has now reached? Do you want a no deal or do you want to stay in the EU? Obviously, one of the leave options would be knocked out. So a week later, you present the country with the question of, do you want a no deal or do you want to remain?
Or, Jenny, the remain option might be knocked out.
Or, well, except the country split 50-50. So I very much doubt that that would be the case. And then everybody would have a say and everybody would be voting on the practical realities that lie ahead of us instead of this mythical world in which we can get everything that we want without any cost. And but that's why I think it's really important that Labour open up this debate, or God knows whether they will.
But Labour's biggest success of the 2017 general election was to
fudge everything.
Completely fudge everything. I mean, it was Keir Starmer's greatest triumph that he came up with this sort of...
But you can't do it endlessly.
You can't.
Well, you can, though. When the government is in the mess that it is... I mean, I agree with you, the way they sort of completely vacate the field is outrageous. On Friday, when just before Theresa May gave her statement, which is very, very cross with Brussels, I tweeted saying that as the government just completely falls apart on Brexit, the leader of the opposition was tweeting about a pumping station in Leicester.
No message was there.
He tweeted a video which he'd been to see to promote the work and what he wants to do with water companies. And as lots of very cross people pointed out, water bills are a big issue for people and it's a very popular policy and it's not just all about Brexit. But there was a clear sense of the Prime Minister is about to address an ungrateful nation about the latest hash he's made or something. And he's just sort of existing in
he's
this
crooked,
parallel world. And there's a line that comes from Barry Gardner Down that if when your enemy is making a mistake, you don't interrupt them. And I think if you want to reverse this chart, which shows that the people who think you would make a good Prime Minister is going down, you do have to step up and address that.
You'd be stepping up into a context that has been created by the Conservative government because they've messed up the negotiations. So what do you want Labour to do? Turn up now and say, this is what we would take? Because actually, Labour wouldn't be in this position if they were negotiating. We wouldn't be in a position where, you know, we're not going to get the deal through Parliament and
because they would squeak through and it got a hung parliament like Theresa May has, he could be in exactly the same position. And his 6 tests, including all the same benefits, would, as Barry Gardner described, they are bollocks and they don't work.
because he doesn't have the same hard right Brexiteers in his party that Theresa May does.
He is the hard right Brexiteer.
This is one of the biggest.
Did you discuss Europe with him when you were working? What's his genuine view?
He voted and campaigned for Remain. And he campaigned. So his view is that we should have remained in the European Union, although
remained and reformed.
Yes, of course. The European Union has a lot of problems, right? No one would disagree with that, even if you're massively pro-European Union.
Everyone would agree with that, I think. But hang on a minute. If he believed we should remain, why didn't he campaign for it?
Because he did.
No, he didn't. Because during the election...
He went on holiday.
During the election, I went out
for the... He literally went on holiday.
During the election, I went out for the Times to spend 24 hours alongside David Cameron as he was campaigning. And he said, he was absolutely... literally tearing his hair out. He said, we keep saying to Corbyn, we will clear space in the diary, you can have any sort you like, you can make any speeches you please, we'll make sure that nothing conflicts with it, you know, please come out and talk about Brexit. And he said, he just won't engage, he won't do it, he won't get the Labour vote out. And you know, if anyone would like to come back and tell me any single thing that they remember Corbyn standing up and saying or stumping about, as he now... does about, you know, allotments or filling stations, so please tell me about it.
And I know he didn't want to share a stage with David Cameron, and that's his prerogative, but I remember speaking to Alan Johnson at the time, who was leading the Labour campaign, who had similar frustrations. He kept trying to arrange meetings and was being rebuffed, and, I mean, it's just not the case that he's an enthusiastic Remain campaigner.
To be honest, I thought the Labour In campaign wasn't a good campaign, but it wasn't run by Corbyn. It was run by Alan Johnson.
Maybe it should have been.
Maybe it should have been. I think it would be if there was another referendum. I think it would be run by Corbyn and run by Momentum and whatever.
And it would be better. Would they campaign to remain? You see, that's the other fascinating thing is Labour did back a second referendum, then what position does it take?
Yes,
do you think Corbyn would have to campaign to remain in that situation?
It's a hypothetical question. I think we have to wait until we see what deal the government comes back with, whether they can get it through Parliament. She might need to extend Article 50. And carry on negotiating, or might have that the part of the trade-off for being able to extend Article 50 might be another vote, referendum.
Labour have already said that they will vote down whatever deal she brings back, and now you're saying it depends.
Yeah, no, they would vote down Chequers, because Chequers doesn't give you exactly the same benefits as... It was the Conservative...
Why did
David Davis say that? Yeah. And why did Liam Fox say
that?
Hold on a minute. He's the Brexit secretary.
Yeah, and he's a lunatic. Yes, he didn't understand the constraints, and that's why he's gone.
This is politics. If you're the government, you're saying we're going to get the exact same benefits, it's going to be the easiest deal to do in history, and hold on to it.
And he was proved wrong. So why would you now be proved right? He was trying to defy gravity. He was trying to break all the rules and pretend he could fly. He couldn't fly. That's why he's crashed and burnt. Why do you think you could fly? You can't have the exact same benefits while leaving. It's nonsense.
In theory, you could negotiate a bilateral trade deal with the EU, but they've gone about it the wrong way. In theory, you could, as Canada has done.
Yes, and then you don't belong to the same single regulatory system, and we know about all the non-tariff barriers, and the idea that frictionless trade would be absolute garbage under that. And Matt, you must know that. You're an intelligent person.
Let's, at the risk of this turning into a Brexit seminar...
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let me posit a counter view, which it might just be the inbuilt optimist in me that hopes everything's going to be all right at the end, that despite what happened in Salzburg, Theresa May does get some sort of agreement with the EU because it is in the interest of both sides. She brings it back to Parliament, and in the end, the number of Tory rebels will go down because most of them don't want to push the country off the cliff. And there will be some Labour MPs who, whatever the front bench line is, because they don't want to be seen to be supporting this government plan, there will be some Labour MPs who can't bring themselves to walk through a voting lobby with Jacob Rees-Mogg and that wing of the Tory party and actually think that a deal is better than no deal. And so we get through this and we leave in March next year. What happens then? How do both parties adjust to, in theory, life after Brexit? And particularly the possibility that Theresa May gets hauled out of Downing Street quite soon after, with Jeremy Corbyn's calculation that just let Theresa May muck it up and he can come and clean it all up afterwards. The Tories could rejuvenate.
It does feel as if politics is in limbo. I don't know that so many things are put on hold until after Brexit, if Brexit happens or whatever. So, you know, Vince Cable's said it, that, you know, he'll go after Brexit. The Labour moderates, or whatever you want to call them, are not leaving until after Brexit. The Tory MPs aren't going to move against Theresa May until after Brexit. There's an awful lot's got to happen in April and May next year to kind of catch up for all the kind of decisions that are being deferred, let alone any kind of domestic policy that the government's been totally ignoring and governing. But I think you're going to have a sort of... I really feel as if the sort of Rubik's Cube has been scrambled, if you like, and everything is kind of... is a real mess. All the old tribal allegiances are breaking down, and that's all going to come to a head after March the 29th next year. And I think we genuinely don't know what's going to happen, because I think it depends who wins the Tory leadership contest. If that's a sort of Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, hard right winger, I think genuinely a lot of a chunk of Tory MPs will leave. I can't see Jeremy Corbyn going anywhere by choice fast, but the Labour moderates are then going to have to make their choice. They've got no more excuse for hanging around. Do they want to make this man Prime Minister or not? So I think you could have some kind of reconfiguration. There's all this talk of a new party, lots of, you know, businessmen with lots of money flocking around.
We're in tune with the national mood.
Yes, exactly.
A couple of people you haven't heard of with loads of money who want to take over politics. Rosa, what do you think about Theresa May? You've written a book about her as well. Is it in her nature to think, well, I've delivered what I said I was going to do, I'll go quietly, or having done that, will she think, finally, I can get on with the stuff I'm really interested in?
Right at the beginning, when you introduced me, you said, could I compare the two? And actually, they're not from dissimilar backgrounds. You know, they're both sort of middle England, though, of a similar age, relatively well-off, dutiful people. They came from different traditions, because Theresa May's family, her father was an Anglican vicar, Jeremy Corbyn's father was a scientist, and they were quite active Labour activists themselves, but both families had a real sense of duty. And I do definitely see Theresa May as seeing it as her mission, having been elected following the referendum, to see it through. One of the big criticisms of Theresa May is that she's not an ideologue. She doesn't have much of an agenda. You know, I think most of the country would quite like to get on with domestic policy once Brexit is out of the way. I don't think Theresa May knows what she wants to do with the country. In the beginning, she had Nick Timothy thinking for her, and they came up with almost a coherent plan, but that sort of fell by the wayside quite quickly, as she just has been scrambling to deal with each day as a, you know, it's an achievement at the end of the day if she gets through it. I wonder if Jeremy Corbyn is almost similar. For him, it's not Brexit that he needs to get through. It's his mission, rather, to transform the Labour Party. I mean, the Corbynistas, I believe, despite all Matt said, I think their big prize is Labour. It's not achieving power. It's not achieving government. And if he can get all these changes through conference, if he can solidify Corbynism and get rid of the moderates, perhaps, I think Rachel's right, I think perhaps after Brexit, some of those moderates will think about forming their own party. If he can transform the party in his own image, his work here will be done, and I think that will be a time. So I think Theresa May will probably go quite quickly in the spring, and I think Corbyn will take maybe another year or so, but he'll be gone after that.
So who do we think will lead the two parties into the next election? Let's go along the panel, then we'll take some questions. Jenny?
I think it could well be Michael Gove.
For which party?
I, I mean, not because I'm enthusiastic about this proposition, but I mean, you all have noticed how very carefully Michael has positioned himself, agreeing to go along with Chequers, being very, very loyal. The director of communications in Downing Street is a very close friend of his. He's got allies all over the party. He's experienced what it's like to have lost power, very shockingly, in two stages. First, when he got sacked as education secretary, and then when Theresa came in and he was evicted from the cabinet. And
he had to make do with being a Times columnist for a while.
He did, didn't he? He was as much grander than we were, much more. But I think he might be somebody, if the party wants a Brexiteer, he's being very cautious and very clever about making alliances across the party in a way that someone like Boris Johnson has utterly failed to do. I mean, Boris absolutely is at home in front of a great crowd, but in the Commons tea room, he just doesn't bother with it, which means a lot of MPs dislike him intensely. And the only reason they may back him is they think he may save their seats. Well, Michael will be presenting himself as, I can save your seats because, you know, I'll do the Brexit true path. And don't worry, PS, I'll deliver a really harder Brexit than we have at the moment. So I think that's a possibility. As for Labour, I have no bloody idea.
I wonder if, sticking with Labour, someone like Emily Thornberry might triumph, sort of just about palatable to the left, but also acceptable to the moderates, and she's been plugging away there. I think the members kind of like her. You know, she's one of the few with a bit of oomph to her, so I'm going for Emily Thornberry. This is, by the way, wild speculation because I've proved...
That's all we're doing. That's our job.
And for the Tories, I wonder if once Brexit is out of the way, maybe the leavers will just sort of eat themselves up like they did last time around. And I wonder if someone like Jeremy Hunt sort of will want a safe pair of hands again. You know, Tories are very sensible when it comes down to it. And they have these, what do we meant to say, erotic spasms every now and then. But they...
Exotic spasms.
I'm going to go for Jeremy Hunt and Emily Thornberry.
Excellent. And in fact, I'm interviewing Emily Thornberry at the Labour conference this week, which will be a podcast later in the week. So I shall ask her if she... fancies, if she wants to launch a leadership bid on the Red Box podcast. Rachel, who do you think will lead?
I was going to mention Emily Thornberry as well, actually. And it's quite interesting. Several of the people have been saying they think it should be a woman next. And I think Rebecca Long Bailey's being cited as a sort of John McDonnell favourite candidate. But Emily Thornberry could be more of a broad church person, I guess. On the Tory side, I think Sajid Javid's also an interesting person to watch. I can see a sort of the final two being Sajid Javid against Jeremy Hunt. I
just a contest think Boris, to set the nation's Boris, policies racing.
I think Boris is over. I don't know whether that's wishful thinking, but I think it's sort of he's made so many enemies in the parliamentary party. They're really fed up with him. And in the end, they do have to decide who gets to the final two to get to the party activists who choose.
And it will be fascinating to see how he's received at the Tory conference next week. Because last year, he was really unpopular because he was seen as being disloyal. It'll be interesting to see how that's
really fascinating.
Finally, Matt, who do you think will lead the parties into the next election?
Into the next election, I think Corbyn will be leading Labour. Following Corbyn's leadership, I think it will be a contest between two women on the left of the party. I would consider Emily Thornberry as being on the left of the party, possibly Rebecca Long Bailey. There's going to be new mechanisms to get onto the ballot paper for the leadership contest. I don't know if you've seen this now. You're going to need 5% of the unions, 5% of the affiliates, and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, it would have to be someone like Emily Thornberry or Rebecca Long Bailey. So,
Angela Rayner?
Possibly also, yeah.
Yeah.
The Tories, I think Sajid Javid will take over from May.
Well, we'll hold you all to those predictions, because we all know that political predictions are wildly successful these days. Thank you so much for joining us for this special recording of the live podcast. I'm not totally sure we're any clear on whether or not we've reached peak Corbyn. That's sort of the point of politics. Now we just get together and reassure ourselves that nobody else knows what's going on either. Thank you all for coming. You're already Time subscribers, but for those of you that aren't, do sign up to become Time subscribers. Then you get my brilliant Red Box morning email, which I get up at 5 o'clock every morning to write. But for now, my thanks to Jenny Russell, Rosa Prince, Rachel Sylvester, and Matt Zarb Cousin. And for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.